Good afternoon. I'm Wendy Nicholson, co-chair of the Friends Program Committee. My co-chair, Lynn Goldberg, and all the volunteer members of the committee are very pleased to offer you today's program, and we thank you for coming. Before we begin, will you please take a moment to make certain you have turned off your cell phone? And during the question and answer period, Mr. Buckley will take questions. If you want to ask a question, please go to the microphones. There are microphones on either side of the auditorium. It makes it much easier for not only Mr. Buckley to hear you, but also the other members of the audience. The cell phone symphony. We hope everyone here is a friend of the library. Events such as today's lecture are one way of thanking you for your ongoing support. The library is counting on you, its most loyal supporters, to help provide the books and services required to meet the needs of its 44 million users. This becomes especially important during challenging economic times. Library always sees an increase in use during these times, and the number of library visits is up 22% over this time last year. Please consider increasing your gift this year because the need is very great. Every contribution is important, no matter its amount. We cannot take this extraordinary institution for granted, and we need every one of you to participate in the effort to sustain it. If you are a guest this afternoon, we hope you will become a friend of the library. Membership brochures are available at the table by the doorway. If you would like to get information about upcoming programs by email, there is a sign-up sheet at the membership table. Following today's lecture, books will be available for purchase, and Mr. Buckley will sign them. These sales benefit the library. It is also worth mentioning that the speakers who come to the library generously donate their time. Which brings us to today's speaker. Christopher Buckley is Washington's preeminent and best-selling satirist. Since publication of The White House Mess in 1986, he has written 8 more outrageous comic novels, entertaining readers with lively ridicule of UFO cultists, tobacco lobbyists, irresponsible baby boomers, a divinely inspired investment guru, and in his newest work, an entire branch of government, the Supreme Court. Christopher Buckley knows Washington well and has known it for a very long time. At age 29, he became chief speechwriter to the Vice President of the United States, George H.W. Bush. In 1989, Mr. Buckley founded and became editor-in-chief of Forbes FYI magazine, where he is currently editor-at-large. He is the author of 13 books, most of them national bestsellers. They have been translated into 16 languages. They include Boomsday, The White House Mess, Wet Work, Thank You for Smoking, God is My Broker, Little Green Men, No Way to Treat a First Lady, Florence of Arabia, and his newest, Supreme Courtship, which has just been published. Thank You for Smoking has been made into a movie starring Aaron Eckhart, Robert Duvall, William Macy, Rob Lowe, Adam Brody, and Katie Holmes, in case any of you want to go see it. Little Green Men is being made into a movie starring John Malkovich and directed by Whit Stillman. In his spare time, Mr. Buckley has contributed over 60 comic essays to The New Yorker magazine, and his journalism, satire, and criticism has been widely published in both newspapers and magazines, including The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Vanity Fair, and Esquire. He is the recipient of the 2002 Washington Irving Medal for Literary Excellence, and in 2004, he was awarded the Thurber Prize for American Humor. Please welcome Christopher Buckley.
Thank you very much, Wendy. It's lovely to be here. Thank you for coming out on this lovely day. I'm in the middle of a curious form of torture known as the book tour. And So if I make very little sense today, that's my excuse. The other day I did one of those things. It's called a satellite TV tour, where they lock you in a room with a robotic camera. So right away you feel like a microbe or a virus or something. And you have an earpiece, and the technician whispers into your ear, next one is Mike from Minneapolis. I did 15 consecutive live TV interviews around the country. So he said, it's next one, Mike from Minneapolis. I said, okay. So a voice comes on and says, Mr. Buckley. And I said, oh, well, yes. So have you gotten rid of all those Republicans? And there was this sort of pause. And he said, well, we still have a few left. I said, I said, well, how's my friend Al Franken doing? And there was this pause. Well, it wasn't Mike in Minneapolis. It was Kevin in Tulsa. So, you know, book tours are really often an occasion for disaster. Those, you know, on the back flap of the book, were that about the author paragraph, after 7 or 8 books or however many, I started to get sort of bored with them, so I just started making the stuff up. And it was 5 or 6 books ago. It was a little book called Little Green Man, and so I wrote, he has been an advisor to every American president since William Howard Taft. So I was on book tour and walking into an AM drive time talk radio station. There's a food chain, you know. Up here you have NPR and Terry Gross and Lenny Lopate and, you know, people who actually may have read the book, you know. And then down here you have the drive time AM talk shows. And so I walked in, and the host, to use a gracious word, was sitting there speed reading about the author, sort of with beetling brow, sort of. And I knew instantly that this would be all he would know about me and the book. So he looked up at me and said, you were an advisor to William Howard Taft? And I said, because I was on book tour and I was frankly a little punchy, and I said, yeah. Yeah, I was. And he said, well, so we could talk about that. And I said, sure. Yeah, we talked about that. So we did. And I don't think I'll be asked back on that particular talk show, but, you know, it was worth it. It was worth it. This is, as Wendy graciously pointed out, my 13th book. My 13th book. Lucky 13. My publisher's name is 12. So this is 13 by 12. I have written a bunch of... I went down to Washington in, 1981. Why, some of you weren't even born then. Actually, I think all of you were born. And it was a funny time. I'll tell you, before I talk about the book, to talk a little bit about that. It was just after Hinckley had shot Reagan. You know, John Wilkes Booth shot Lincoln to avenge the South, and John Hinckley shot Reagan to impress Jodie Foster. And there, in a way, you have the trajectory of idealism in the American political assassin. But it was an attention-getting event. And if you were a member of the what they called, I was the speechwriter to the vice president, and if you were a member of what they called the traveling staff, or the what the French would call the entourage, French have a better word for anything, you got a briefing from the Secret Service on sort of what to look for in a suspicious-looking crowd, much like this one. And this consisted of sitting in a darkened basement room in the old executive office building, that wonderful building right next to the White House that looks like a Victorian wedding cake, watching home assassination movies. Sort of America's least funny home videos. We had the Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination, backwards and forwards with expert commentary. And you say, now watch this. And you're sitting there. We had Arthur Bremer shooting George Wallace. And one of the movies, I've never been able to get it out of my mind, was an attempt on President Park of South Korea. And he was... President Park is at a podium, much like this, a huge audience, 5,000 people. And Mrs. Park is seated over here in a chair, looking up adoringly at President Park. And so this is just the most exciting speech she's ever heard in her life. It was probably a speech about dumping Hyundais on the American auto market or something. And the stage is full of Secret Service, the guys with the dark glasses. And, you know, with like machine guns. So a man in the midst of the President Park's going on. And a man just starts to walk down the center aisle. And he... calm as can be, practically stopping to light a cigarette on the way, and he gets to about there and reaches in and pulls out a .357 Magnum and sort of takes his time getting comfortable, checking the windage, and starts blanging away at the podium, and President Park just does this. He just goes... as though this happens all the time. You can practically hear him saying, God, I hate this part. Boy, when you die in Seoul, you really die. Now, his Secret Service detail senses that something is amiss. Panther-like reflexes, right? And one of them does something that I thought was interesting from a career point of view. He goes over and takes cover behind Mrs. Park. He's trading shots with the guy. And Mrs. Park's head just does this. She's killed, He's using the First Lady as a shield. And so I was just a pot-smoking English major who'd, gone down to Washington to do a speechwriting gig, but I was sort of having a, I don't think I'm in Kansas anymore, Toto moment. And the Secret Service agent giving us the briefing said, well, we don't do it this way. I said, well, that's great. That's good. So you won't be using me as a shield, But then he said, if something goes down, that deplorable phrase, it's going down, you basically have two choices. I said, yes. I said, you could duck or take the round. Said, what was the second part? Anyway, so that was my introduction to Washington. So I wrote... I've written books about it. This is the 13th, and I write about Washington institutions, and I've written about the White House, the Congress, the State Department, the CIA, FBI, NASA. I'm sort of running out of Washington institutions. I'm pretty soon going to have to write a book about Arlington National Cemetery or something. That's right. But although something tells me don't go there. So I thought, the Supreme Court. Why not the Supreme Court? This is a Himalaya as institutions go. It is not, I write comedy, and it is not inherently a laugh riot. The Supreme Court, as a character in the book, says it's nine old farts in black robes sending footnotes to each other. But, every now and then the court does something funny, like, decide one of our presidential elections. That's funny. Harry Truman famously, some of you may remember Harry Truman, had a sign on his desk that said, "The buck stops here." Now the buck just simply goes, the buck pauses there before going basically up, generally to the Supreme Court. Sometimes it goes through Congress, spends a minute there. By the way, just a little aside, this economic bailout bill that Paulson sent them, 3.5 pages. Have you seen what it's now up to? 428, yeah. And still going. It's gone from the size of a memo to War and Peace. That's Washington for you. The U.S. tax code is 10 million words. And it's a very funny reading. But anyway, Harry Truman, the buck stops here. The buck really stops is at the Supreme Court, I think, which would make a good slogan, a motto over the portico. The buck stops here. The actual motto engraved in the portico of the Supreme Court is equal justice under law, which is, it's okay, but I've always wanted to redo the slogans on the Washington official buildings, because I think some of them are a little, frankly, dull and out of date. The National Archives, I bet our director, David Ferrario, knows what's engraved over the archives building. "The past is prologue." From Shakespeare. Okay, it's okay, but I think we could do better. I would say you could Google it. Right? Right? Past is prologue. Please. The Justice Department. $10 to anyone here who can tell me what the motto of the Justice Department engraved over the door is. No takers. Well, I'm not surprised, because it's "Justice is founded in the rights bestowed by nature upon man." Oh, who got paid for coming up with that? Really. I would change it to just one word. Freeze. Or maybe step away from the vehicle. The Pentagon doesn't even have a slogan. And this is a building that cries out for a real sort of kick-ass slogan. "Make my day." Since 2003, nation building. Which we weren't going to do, too. Anyway, it's very imposing, the Supreme Court. Has anyone here actually been inside the Supreme Court? It's worth a visit. It's very august. It's a working Greek temple, and there aren't many of those left. thank God. And you feel. You feel very abashed. You feel like sort of a schoolboy all over again, like you don't pick your nose, because Zeus is watching and he will hurl a thunderbolt. When it was built, the present building in 1934, one of the justices famously said, they thought it was a bit over the top, and he said, "Now we're going to look like nine black beetles in the Temple of Karnak." So whenever I see the group photo of them. This coming Monday, you will see the group photo because it's the first Monday in October. I always think of the nine black beetles in the Temple of Karnak. So I thought, let's have a crack at the Supreme Court. Let's try a satire about the Supreme Court. Now, most novels about the Supreme Court these days, they begin with the Chief Justice being assassinated by the pharmaceutical industry because his corrupt clerk has revealed that he's going to vote against renewing the patent for the restless leg syndrome drug. So the day is saved by a gorgeous, not corrupt, female clerk for another justice, who throws in with a very buff investigator, for probably named Brad, for a shadowy government agency that monitors the purity of the restless leg syndrome drugs. And they are thrown together. And there's a spectacular car chase through the reflecting pool, you know, and it ends with a fabulous shootout at the FDR Memorial with bullets zinging off the statue of Eleanor, you know. And Falla, the dog. But I don't write books like that. I should, because then I would make such a lot of money, you know. But other people do those. So I write satire, and satire is a challenge. Writing satire in America today it's a no-win proposition. You're competing with the front page of USA Today. I would be hard-pressed to come up with a hypothetical situation that could top what you see on the evening news. One of my favorite stories is about the teenage boy who has to do a paper for school on the difference between hypothetical and reality. And so he goes up to his dad one night in his study and asks him if he could give him a hand, and the father thinks for a bit and says, "Well, go ask your mother if she would sleep with a total stranger for $1 million. And so he goes away, and he comes back pretty quickly and reports that the answer is, "You bet." And so he says, "Well, go ask your sister." And he comes back lickety-split and reports that the answer is, "Totally." He says, "Well, there you go. Hypothetically, we're sitting on $2 million. In reality, we're living with a couple of hookers. Just apropos the difficulty of doing satire in America, some years ago I did a piece for The New Yorker, one of those back page humor pieces, and I had become sort of fascinated by the proliferation of books about fly fishing. You know, fly fishing used to be fly fishing. You stand in ice-cold water up to your, you know what, for 6 hours and don't catch anything. You go home, have a beer. You've had a perfectly good experience. But then, you know, people started investing it with all sorts of mystical significance, and there were books like Fly Fishing Through the Midlife Crisis and Fly Fishing Through the Divorce and Finding God Through Flying, you know, debates about whether or not God was a dry fly fisherman or a wet fly fisherman. And, you know, you go into Barnes & Noble and it'd be, you know, fiction, nonfiction, fly fishing. So I thought, well, let's have some fun with that. And I wrote a thing. It was reviews in brief about the new crop of fly fishing books. And one of them was, you know, like they were Publishers Weekly reviews, just short paragraphs. And one book was Peter Benchley's new novel called Gills, about a vengeful trout. And another book was called Bass Holes. Yeah, and this was an attack on bass fishermen by a vituperative, prissy, dry fly fisherman who, you know, thought that bass fishermen were low class and, you know, all they cared about were drinking beer and women with big breasts. So a funny thing, you know, so it came out, and a funny thing happened. People started going to bookstores and asking for these books. And the book they really wanted, Bass Holes, you know. So they would go, I don't know, maybe they came to the New York Public Library and tried to, but, you know, they'd go up to the guy at Barnes & Noble behind the desk and say, I can't find Bass Holes. And you go, no, we don't have it. No, you've got to have it. I read about it in the New Yorker. So they started calling the New Yorker, and the New Yorker referred the calls to me. But it just goes to show, you know, it's the pitfalls of trying to commit satire in America today. Anyway, so I was going to write this book about the Supreme Court, and I was on the Acela train. I live on the Acela train. It's the train, you know, between New York and Washington. And in the quiet car. I sit in the quiet car. And I've become I'm the self-appointed Nazi of the quiet car. I go around shushing people. You know, sir, you're not supposed to be on your cell phone. Or, shh, could you hold it down, please? Yeah. My life used to be more exciting. It was sex and drugs and rock and roll. And now I, pardon me for saying this, I've become a librarian. So I was on the train with my legal pad. I thought, okay, I'm going to write a novel about the Supreme Court. I've got to take the notes on a legal pad. Because I think John Grisham makes his notes on a legal pad. Look what it's done for him. He's a billionaire, for God's sake. So I'm on the with my legal pad, and on gets the director of the FBI, Louis Free, and he's with like six other G-men, and he's talking, yakking on, and you know they're all sitting there. They've got the bulges, and they're going, well, you know what we got to do is call. Brad in Minneapolis and get him in on I thought, no, call Mike in Minneapolis. But he was yakking, and so I, you know, I summoned up this, I reached over and tapped him on the shoulder, and he goes, and I sort of stood back. I said, it's the quiet car. So I want you to know, ladies and gentlemen, you are looking at someone who has shushed the director of the FBI. This is going to be in the second paragraph of my obituary, if I get a second paragraph. But anyway, after having shushed the director of the FBI, I went back to staring at my legal pad and thinking, Supreme Court, Supreme Court, Supreme Court. This is how the creator, I wonder if this is how Shakespeare did it. To be or not to be. And I found myself writing down Judge Judy. Now, I've not seen Judge Judy, but I get the idea. You know, I mean, she's very bossy and, you know, has the lace and says, you know, you want to be ashamed of yourself. And so I thought, well, here, okay. Let's get a Judge Judy onto the Supreme Court. Maybe that'll. So I went out on a real limb, and in a Washington novel, and I made a president who is a nice guy. He's not cheating on his wife or taking dirty money from Tashkent, you know, or the restless leg syndrome drugs. He's a nice guy. His name's Donald. You know, because I figured, you know, who could not be nice and have a name Donald? And then people said, Rumsfeld? And I go, okay, well, all right. But he's from Ohio, because it's, I made him from Ohio, because it's a scientific fact. Anyone here from Ohio? No one? Oh, she just doesn't. You are. You are. Well, because it's a scientific fact that everyone from Ohio is nice. No, it's true. It's true. And just for good measure, I made him come from the same hometown as Neil Armstrong. Can anyone tell me the name of the town Neil Armstrong? Come on, he's our biggest hero. Yes. Yes. You're from Ohio. You wouldn't know that if you weren't. Anyway, so President Donald, a very nice guy, and he's just trying to do the right thing. He's trying to do the, you know, he's trying to get down spending and make everything accountable and stop the funny accounting. But he's got this arch enemy who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who just hates him and keeps shooting down all his Supreme Court nominees. And after he shoots down the, and who are completely respectable people, and lions of the bar, and wonderful. So after he shoots down the umpteenth nominee, President Donald flies off to Camp David in a foul mood, and he takes along the first golden retriever, Dwight. And he and Dwight are in bed at night channel surfing, looking for the bowling channel, because that's his great passion, bowling. And he comes across this this TV show, this called Courtroom Six, where the judge in this courtroom reality show is named Pepper Cartwright. She wears glasses. She's very sexy. She sort of looks like a naughty librarian, and she's from Texas, and she packs a pistol under her robes, and it's just like one of the top-rated shows on TV. And so the president, he wasn't even aware of the existence of this. He looked at her going, And she was an actual judge. According to the U.S. Constitution, you don't even have to have been a lawyer to sit on the Supreme Court, much less a judge. So he thinks, okay, let's see you shoot her down. So he nominates her to the court. So I give you, ladies and gentlemen, a book that I handed in January, in which the two antagonists are a glasses-wearing, gun-toting TV hottie pitted against a cosmetically enhanced chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee who has run for president multiple times and can't stop talking. What are you doing tonight around 9 o'clock? After you finish reading Supreme Courtship, I hereby announce my resignation from satire as Yogi Berra said when he was told that a Jewish man had been elected mayor of Dublin, only in America. Happy to take any questions from the floor. There's a lot to talk about these days. Yes, sir, with the very elegant red handkerchief.
I'm going to ask you a question that I once asked William Buckley.
Uh-huh. You might want to, just so other people can hear your question, get a microphone. But, did you give this gentleman a mic?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I
was up at Yale in the 1980s at the time, either just after the Iran-Contra hearings, and William F. Buckley was the speaker at the Associates of the Cushing Whitney Medical Library. Shep Newland had chosen him. He was the chairman at that time. And after the talk, he talked to people up in the front, but there was a collation in the back, and I stayed in the back. And then when he was coming down towards the back to go up to a dinner that they were having, they had a special dinner for people, I said, I came up to him, I put my hand out to introduce myself to him, and I said, I'm Bruce Raymer. I said, I'm an antiquarian bookseller. And I said, do you think that Oliver North is a hero? Because he had written a book about heroes. I don't know what the title was. I don't recall. But he walked right past, took his hand back, went right past me up to the room. So I just thought I'd ask you, do you think Oliver North is a hero?
You know, I've honestly never been asked that before. Did you all hear the question? Because I'm not going to repeat it. Oliver, there were two legendary platoon leaders in Vietnam, and one was Oliver North, and the other was Jim Webb, who is now Senator James Webb from Virginia, who's also a very talented novelist. He wrote Fields of Fire. I worked in the White House at the same time Oliver North and Fawn Hall worked there. I used to pass them in the hall, and I thought Fawn Hall was a bit of all right, as Dudley Moore would say. It's a complicated question. I was 4F. I'm no one to... what Oliver North did in Vietnam was absolutely heroic. I've thought of this line from Emerson lately, because you have McCain, who was, absolutely heroic in Vietnam. But you hear that his story again and again and again and again, and it. It's terrible, but it sort of becomes, you've heard it already, and it's Emerson's line, in the end, every hero at last becomes a bore. So that's a slightly evasive way of answering your question, but I'm glad you asked it. Any non-Oliver North questions? Who's going to watch the debate tonight? Show of hands. Yeah, okay. this is a tough one. It's sort of tough for Biden, too. I like Biden. Hell, I made him a character in my book. But he does have this, ability, if there is a foot within 100 yards, he will insert it in his mouth if there is room left over after his own foot. So it's, I was trying to think, if I were his handler, his coach, how I would advise him. And I think I would sort of advise him just to pretend she's not there. just don't look this way, just look and, keep the answers slightly short. He has a sort of magnificent awkwardness, Biden, although it makes him very real, I find. The other week when he turned, there was a fundraiser in Missouri, and the state senator was paralyzed in a wheelchair, and Biden turns and says, come on, Carl, stand up so everyone can see you. And he went, oh, my God. But these moments, they sort of make him authentic somehow, and I think there's a great hankering for authenticity, because it's all so inauthentic. Yes, ma'am.
I bring you greetings from one of your first alma maters, St. David's School. I think I knew you when you were 9 or 10 years old, and I was teaching first grade. Anyway, I think you learned some satire from David Hume, our headmaster at the time.
And
I'm Alice Timothy. I was first grade teacher when you were up there in the third or fourth grade. Anyway, but I remember you, and I hope you learned a few lessons from our wonderful St. David's. I'm sure you did. And thank you for coming today. Bye-bye.
St. David's School up on 89th Street. Great school. I served Mass at Carolyn Kennedy's confirmation. Yeah, we were, you know, dragooned and that. Yes?
I just was wondering if you have any plans to write any essays about the current political situation? Any facet of it, really?
Yes, yes.
Or if it, is it, are there, is it too much?
Well, it is too much. But I write a column on the back page of the National Review magazine. Maybe you've heard of that. I figured that at least now that my dear old dad's dead, they can't accuse me of nepotism. And as of Monday, I'm going to be a regular columnist in Tina Brown's new website, which has a marvelous name. It's from the newspaper in Evelyn Waugh's Scoop. It's called The Daily Beast. So I want you all online Monday, and I have a new column, and it's called What Fresh Hell is the name of the column. And you all remember where that's from, of course, the Dorothy Parker's it's the best title ever in the history of titles. What Fresh Hell is This? It describes so much.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
If somebody over here. Chris. Let me just. Yeah, yes, ma'am.
Yes, the public face of your father was not one of being humorous. I'd like to know where you get your wonderful sense of humor.
Well, he was a pretty funny guy, you know. But my mother. That's a safe answer in this crowd, right? No, she was. My mother was a. You know about my mom, you know, Pat Buckley. She. I've written a book about them, actually. Called Losing Mom and Pop. I lost both of them in the course of 10 months. And I hadn't planned to write about them because it was a very complex thing. But I kind of had to. So it's a memoir of my last year. So that will be... But she was... My mother was quite a remarkable woman. She was from... Vancouver, British Columbia, and she used to say, I'm just a simple girl from the backwoods of British Columbia. Henry Kissinger, at her memorial service, said, he quoted her saying that, and then he said, if Pat Buckley was a simple girl from the backwoods of British Columbia, I would tremble to meet a sophisticated girl from the backwoods of British Columbia. That was my Henry Kissinger imitation.
Chris, I ran with your Uncle Jim for office here in 1970, and I'm a friend of your aunt and an admirer of the Buckley family. And I think one insight that would be interesting to all of us is your thoughts, now that his reign is almost over, your thought of George W. Bush.
Well, I think it's good news for James Buchanan. Very good news for James Buchanan. They're at the Buchanan Library. They're going, yes, yes. I worked for his father, and I don't think there is a kinder, sweeter, more decent guy on the face of the planet. I love George H.W. Bush. He did have this sort of funny. Here's this, sweet Episcopalian man from Greenwich, Connecticut, and he had this funny things sort of happen to him, like vomiting on the lap of the Japanese prime minister. So, that's got to be embarrassing, right? He had this sort of sweet awkwardness. He shortly after he left the White House in 93, he went to Pebble Beach and played in one of those celebrity pro-am golf tournaments. And President Ford was playing, Clint Eastwood, the usual suspects. And he teed off the first tee and sliced wickedly and at very high velocity into the skull of a woman spectator, and you could almost hear on TV sort of the liquidy sound, and he oh my God, and he ran over, and the medics are applying pressure bandages, and he's hovering there apologizing frantically, but because it was being televised, they dragged him away. They said, "Mr. President, the show has to go on." So a couple of hours later, he's lining up his putt on the 17th green. He looks over, and there's a woman in a wheelchair with her head swathed in bandages. And he goes, "Oh, my God." So, and he starts apologizing to her all over again. And she's looking at him like something like this. And someone taps him and says, "No, Mr. President, that's someone else. She was hit by Clint Eastwood." I'll leave you with one sweet George Bush story. Do we have time for 2.5 minutes? I can do this in 2 minutes and 20 seconds. But, I went down to Washington. I was 29. I was young. I had all my possessions in the back of my VW Rabbit, and I drove down to Washington one night, down 95. And, I felt I was releasing my inner Mr. Smith, And I got lost, of course. But I looked up, and there was the dome of the Capitol building gleaming, and it was really this sort of lump in your throat moment. And I thought, this is going to be so great. I'm going to be chief speechwriter to the Vice President of the United States. I thought, this is so awesome. This is going to change the course of history as we know it. My speeches will be reprinted in full on the New York Times and studied, analyzed in the Kremlin, And then I quickly realized no one cared what the vice president said. We could never get press coverage. The only press coverage we could get was the guy from C-SPAN who would come and set up his camera on a tripod in the back of the room just in case someone shot him and then go smoke in the lobby. And then one day in December 1981, the Cold War heated up. Remember the Cold War? God, that was so much more fun than this one. And the Poles declared martial law, and Russian tank divisions were moving in, and it was. And Bush was scheduled to give a speech anyway the next day, so they said, Bush will give the administration response, and so the whole world was watching, all the press corps wanted to come. So I thought, well, this is fabulous. This is my moment. And being a, highly educated person, I went to Bartlett's Familiar Quotations and found a quote from Thucydides. And, it's always nice to have a little... There he is. It's always nice to have a little classical parsley in the speech. And so... Bush is giving the speech, and it's a big crowd, live media coverage, and he's And he's doing great. He's doing great. Until he got to the line about Thucydides, and something happened. He looks and he goes, is the Greek historian he was like a parrot with a piece of banana caught in his throat. I was at the staff table with Admiral Murphy, who was the four-star Navy admiral who was Mr. Bush's chief of staff. And you know, I'd been at St. David's and at with Benedictine monks for 4 years. So I thought I knew about figures of authority. And then I went to work for a U.S. Navy admiral, and boy, are they strict. And Admiral Murphy is glowering at me. And I'm going, I didn't make this word up, you know. And Bush said, and finally, it went on and on. Finally, he spat it out, Thucydides. And afterwards, Admiral Murphy came up and he poked me in the chest and said, next time, say Plato. So, goodbye.